Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me this week is Allison Wiseman. Allison, how are you this week?
I'm doing good. Do you know what today is, by chance?
It's the day after my wife's birthday. What is...
Okay, well, happy birthday. It's Super Tuesday.
Oh, God. Yeah, it is Super Tuesday. It is so weird. I feel like no one cares that it's Super Tuesday.
No one cares. Facebook and Instagram were down all morning on Super Tuesday, so it's fine.
You know, I know that, like the presidential primaries are kind of foregone conclusions, but then also, I mean, I know a lot of states just do the presidential stuff, but there's like a lot of down ballot stuff that's getting decided today. Like, I think the California Senate race is up in the air, and I think there's a couple of other like kind of major House and U.S. Senate races that are going on. But yeah, it seems like people are just like, oh yeah, that's today. Like me, like, yeah, I just was. Yes.
Compared to 4 years ago, you know, 4 years ago this week, I guess, was the last normal week we would have for a long time. And we had like a really contested Super Tuesday.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was like the Biden Bernie showdown, and then we had COVID. Yeah, that was nuts. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah. Oof, that was just 4 years ago. That's crazy. That also is crazy. What are we talking about today? Today, Allison and I are going to be talking about three topics. Only one of them involves the Kentucky General Assembly, which thank God for that. There's plenty more to talk about. We're just not going to talk about it. The main thing, I think, the first thing we're going to talk about on the show is Mitch McConnell. Some news about Mitch McConnell. He is leaving his leadership post. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that. Anthony Piacentini, this is a story we've been tracking for, you know, probably a year or more at this point. He is on trial officially in front of the Metro Council. We talked slightly about this last week, but I think there's only one day of the trials. We're going to catch up on the rest of it. And then we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the IVF bills that are making their way through the session. That is out of a story in Alabama. We're going to be talking to everybody about that if, in case you missed it, all that kind of stuff. So without any further ado, Allison, you ready to talk about Mitch McConnell?
Always
ready to. So, Allison, you were working for Charles Booker on his campaign in the last time around, 2022. Were you involved in the 2020 Senate race at all?
I was a little bit for Charles, since I've known Charles personally and his family for a few years now, longer than him running for Senate. I was doing some personal volunteer work in 20. But then in 20, after the primary, I actually interned on the McGrath campaign and then was hired full time on the McGrath campaign in around August. So I worked full time for about the last 3 months of that campaign against.
So you have
worked on the campaign against him.
You've worked as staff on a campaign against Mitch McConnell. Allison's a campaign expert. She's like the queen of campaigns in Kentucky, basically. I have not very often been paid staff on campaigns, but I was trying to think about like all of the races against Mitch McConnell that I have like volunteered for, and I got to tell you, it goes back a long way. The first one that I like remember happening was Lois Combs Weinberg, and I think that was like 2002 or something. It was a long, long time ago. I was in high school.
I don't even know who that is.
Yeah. I don't think many people walking in to the ballot box that year knew who she was. Fair. So that is what it is. But yeah, the news has broke last week that Mitch McConnell is going to be stepping down from his leadership post in the United States Senate, where he's the Republican leader right now. That's the minority leader, but he's gone back and forth between minority and majority leader a lot since 2007, when he became, I guess at that time, minority leader. He took over from Bill Frist, who was the senator from Tennessee. Fun facts. He got into leadership because Trent Lott left. This is all old news. These are all names you probably have never heard of, Allison. Yeah.
Never heard of.
Yeah, that's a break you didn't count on. Both of those two are not super legit people. Mitch McConnell, though, is resigning his leadership position, but he is not resigning his seat. So he is going to be remaining in the United States Senate. He has occupied that seat since 1985, 1 year before I was born, and I'm pretty old. So his current term expires in 2026. He has not said whether or not he's going to run for re-election, but he seems to be signaling pretty heavily that he will be hanging it up at the end of this term. Now, weirder things have happened than Mitch McConnell running for re-election, but that seems to be the direction it's pointing in right now. A lot of people have talked about Mitch McConnell's legacy in the past week. If you ask me, it's mostly bad. I think he came into power, well, he came into his leadership position during what was the thickest part of the Iraq War. Of course, you know, this was the end of the Bush administration. Of course, the Iraq War continued for the first several years of the Obama administration. But this was like the last time the Republicans had full ownership of the Iraq War. And he was a strong supporter of basically all of the worst policies of the Bush administration, which were quite bad. You know, the bankruptcy bill, which is responsible for all student loans not being able to be discharged in bankruptcy. He was a big supporter of the move to have Social Security privatized and moved into the public or moved into, you know, retirement accounts that would be managed in the stock market. He was a big proponent of a lot of really bad ideas that the Bush administration had. If you ask me, the top among them is the Iraq War, which he was a strong supporter of. Now, of course, after 2007, not too long after that, Barack Obama came into office, and one of the most famous Mitch McConnell quotes is to say that it was his number one priority to make Barack Obama a one-term president. He failed at that. That was not a successful push by Mitch McConnell. And then at the end of the 8 years of Obama's administration, he of course blocked a replacement for Antonin Scalia from being placed onto the Supreme Court. Mitch McConnell has called that there's a word he uses, the most consequential, maybe. There's something like that. It's like meaningful. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal that he did that there at the end of the Obama administration when he prevented Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, from being put onto the Supreme Court. And instead we got, which one do we get? Neil Gorsuch.
Yeah, Neil.
Who's not great. You know, without Mitch McConnell, Roe versus Wade would be still in effect, but it's not. Donald Trump was, of course, the president after that. And I would say under Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell acted mostly as an enabler. He voted for the acquittal during both of Trump's impeachments, both the first and the second impeachment trials. Although, and this is kind of crazy to me, Allison, Mitch McConnell said that Trump was morally responsible for the January 6th insurrection and then also voted to acquit him in his impeachment trial for technical reasons. But, like, you know, if he had been able to whip some votes on his side to impeach and to convict Donald Trump in the Senate, he would not be able to run for president this time, and we would not have, you know, an insurrectionist on the cusp of returning to the White House. So that's, to me, the things that I remember about Mitch McConnell. In recent days, it's been pretty clear that Mitch McConnell is deeply uncomfortable with the politics of Donald Trump and the return of Donald Trump as the standard bearer for the Republican Party. Of course, they're very different people. Trump and McConnell famously don't get along, and McConnell has become a bit of a punching bag for Trump-aligned politicians who are looking to score points with the party's leader. You know, I'm sure you have some examples of politicians, Republican politicians across the country who are, you know, they will say bad things about Mitch McConnell in hopes of, like, enticing an endorsement from Donald Trump. That's a thing that happens commonly. But I think that one thing, and maybe the biggest thing in both Trump and McConnell's kind of political ideology, is that they are both deeply craven, cynical politicians. I think the difference between McConnell and Trump is that McConnell wraps his cynicism and transactionalism in sort of like this eloquence that we have come to expect from politicians, and Trump just speaks the language of the people, maybe not all the people, all of the people. What does he say? I love the lowly educated. You know, that's the type of person he's speaking to directly. You know, but I do think the ultimate message of both of these men is the same, and that is that they come first, their party comes next, and the country comes last. That, you know, you can, Trump may say it in a little bit more crass and craven language, but that has also been the policy of Mitch McConnell and the way that he has governed. Mitch McConnell doesn't like Trump. But I think it's really important to say that without McConnell's hard work over the past 20 years turning the United States government into basically a cesspit of partisanship and division, Trump's presidency and his return to politics wouldn't be possible. You know, Mitch McConnell has paved the way for Trump. McConnell was among the first people to realize that by reaching for the basest emotions of voters, that power for conservatives was ripe to be taken. He was kind of the person who pulled the conservative wing of the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, turning these people who are basically like FDR Democrats who supported, you know, economic justice, but maybe were not as progressive on other issues, into I will vote for tax cuts for rich people, and I will vote for, you know, cuts to social services as long as it, you know, fits the social politics that I support, which that was the legacy of Mitch McConnell. And that is what's driven us directly towards Donald Trump. I think Mitch McConnell deeply miscalculated how deep the hole was that he was digging there at the whole time that he did that. And now that his career is over and he sits back and looks at what has come because of his work, I hope he looks back with regret and hopefully some sorrow, because I think he's sad about what he's done, and he should be. So that's what I think about Mitch McConnell. Allison, what do you think? What does it mean that Mitch McConnell's leaving? What does it mean for Kentucky? What does it mean for you?
I think for starters, it means that he is not running for re-election in 26. That's what I took from this. You know, this step down is, to me, the first step of him saying that he is not running for re-election in 26. So that's what that means for me. The second thing is, as much as we don't like him, he does bring a lot of power and clout to Kentucky, and, you know, is able to use our name to have a little bit of, you know, oomph, for lack of better terms, behind it. But we all know where Kentucky ranks in terms of overall well-being and quality of life. So not saying that, like, he has done anything to help improve any of that, because he really hasn't. But it has been really cool to say that, you know, Kentucky does have the majority or minority leader. But at the same time, like you talked about, with him enabling so much of what Donald Trump has done, like, it is ridiculous to see so many Republican politicians watch and hear the way that Trump speaks about them or their wives. I mean, he has said racist stuff about Elaine Chao, and Mitch still, at the end of the day, will fill in that ballot box for him. And to me, that shows how much of a coward he is.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's something that I don't respect about him. That's what we would call a real profile in courage. it's ridiculous to see. And you're right. He sat here and said that January 6th was horrible and said Trump was morally responsible for it, but also didn't vote to acquit him. And because of that, we are now legitimately seeing a concern that this man will win the presidency again, and we will have an insurrectionist in the White House because Mitch McConnell was not brave enough to put his foot down. And like you said, he needed only to whip, I think, maybe 6 votes. I think it was 54 people who voted for it. He only needed to whip 6. And if you're the leader of your party and you go to those people who you know are in a swing state, are up for re-election in 22 at that time, and say this, you know, this could have made or break an election seat for him in there. You know, who would have known? Who knows what would have happened in Georgia, for example, in 22? You know, obviously Herschel Walker was a horrible candidate, but you never know. Like, that's a scenario here. Or in Pennsylvania, like, what if Mitch was able to, you know, get better candidates who would openly talk about Trump being an insurrectionist?
Yeah.
Like, we'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I will not miss him at all. Goodbye, good riddance. Thanks for making Kentucky seem cool, but thanks for doing nothing for us, and thanks for enabling an insurrectionist.
Yeah. First of all, I think it's 66 votes to remove.
Oh, is it 2/3 to remove?
It's 60 to break a It's 60 to break a filibuster, right, and 66. So he would have had to whip 12, which, you know, a good, you know, Senate leader can do that, especially for an important vote like
Nancy
this.
Pelosi never had that problem in the House. Let me tell you that.
That's right. Secondly, you know, Allison, you watch baseball. You're a softball player.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know what VORP means?
VORP?
VORP. Yeah, VORP.
I've never heard of that.
Okay, it's value over replacement player, which is basically to say, like, oh gosh, this guy is good, but how much better is he than, like, somebody else who you just, like, put in there? And I wonder about that with Mitch McConnell and everything that everybody has said about, like, how good he's been at, like, bringing stuff to Kentucky. And it is true, he's a lot better than Rand Paul. Rand Paul is historically bad on that level. Like, he just doesn't care about Kentucky at all. But if you have, like, you know, Lucindy Hyde-Smith, well, we don't like her because she's been in the news. You have, what's that girl, the young woman who's a senator from Alabama, Kate Britt. What does Kate Britt bring home for Alabama, and how much less is that than what Mitch McConnell's been able to bring home for Kentucky? And I bet it's not as less as much as you'd think. Like, I bet the difference isn't as much as you'd think. The difference between Mitch McConnell and somebody else in terms of being able to help out Kentucky, I just don't think it's as much as people are making it out to be. And you know, this is, of course, something that he talks about all the time when running for re-election. I think he does a good job of talking about it, but that's what incumbent legislators do. So, you know.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned Rand Paul, because I don't know what other dynamics are like for other, you know, junior and senior senators in other states, but it's pretty well known that Rand and Mitch aren't besties by all means.
Yeah.
And Rand is definitely more to, I don't even know if the right is the right term to describe Rand Paul, but way farther away ideologically than Mitch McConnell is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he announced that he wasn't running for his, you know, leadership position again, I think Rand had like one sentence that was like, thanks for what you've done.
Yeah.
It was a very bland statement. And so it's also, that's interesting, but also it sucks to fear who's going to be next.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially if, you know, President Biden wins again, Biden and Mitch have a very long history together. And it's very obvious when it came to big bills like the infrastructure bill and other things that was there.
Mm-hmm.
But his replacement is going to be Rick Scott. I know John Cornyn from Texas has filed the run for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who knows who it's going to be? And it's going to be someone significantly worse.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how that's possible.
Well, it'll be somebody. Well, and it's very interesting to think about, right? So you do have, like, traditionally, this job would go to, like, John Thune, who's the senator from South Dakota, who's, like, second in line. But, of course, he's highly aligned with Mitch McConnell. He's much more, like, he's much less pro Trump, I guess, than like a John Cornyn or who's the other one that you named there? Rick Scott.
Voldemort.
Yeah, he does kind of look like Voldemort. Also, you know, I think he lived in Kentucky for a long time. Like, I think that's a long story.
Did he really?
Yeah, he was. It's a long story. I'll tell you about it later. but yes, like these other people that are running are significantly, like, you know, more in that vein of like Trumpy. McConnell, you know, has been able to utilize the legislative process. Like, he is like this institutionalist in some form or fashion. I wonder if, like, they get like a Rick Scott in there, or especially like a John Cornyn, are they going to know how to call votes that they know they're going to win? Are they going to be able to get like their caucus together? Are they going to be, I mean, especially in the Senate where you need basically 60 votes to pass anything, like, are they going to be able to get anything done the way that they have been? And that's going to be a really interesting thing. It could be like somebody who's significantly worse in terms of like their beliefs or their policy, but just significantly less effective. I don't know.
Yeah.
It could.
And we definitely have seen that in the House. I mean, mm-hmm. You have Nancy Pelosi, who was just, you know, a dynamite mm-hmm. speaker who could whip the caucus into shape on quite literally anything, and always knew the math, always knew who she needed to get in line and had it done.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Kevin McCarthy, for all his flaws, who was like the minority leader in the House, so had some, you know, knowledge of what that looked like. And then you've got Mike Johnson, who can't even count, who can't whip anything, and they're having embarrassment votes,
right?
Because they can't count to the majority that they need, and it's just so embarrassing to see. And so I agree. Like, I feel like the same thing's going to happen. And the Senate is, the House is pretty tight right now, too, in terms of numbers.
The Senate's always really tight.
The Senate's always tight, and you have to have that caucus in line with anything and everything. I mean, the Democrats aren't any better because of Sinema, which, mm-hmm. goodbye, happy retirement.
I think Democrats are actually probably better off for that.
They're
better
at it, just with those two, her and Manchin, but, like, it's a much different thing in the Senate. It's just mm-hmm. less people, bigger beasts. So it'll be very interesting to see who it ends up being. When do they vote on that? I would assume it's after November.
So
when the swearing in is?
Yeah, the way they do it in federal races, I believe they do the vote. So, actually, I think it's different in the Senate than it is in the House, because I think the Senate is based on a caucus vote. Uh-huh. So, I think, like, the Senate does it in between the election of new senators and their swearing in. So, they do it as a caucus and then announce who the winner is. And then for the House, because Speaker is an election, it's in the Constitution, and it's an election of all of the House. And you have to have not just a majority of your party, but a majority of the entire House. That is actually done after the swearing in of all the new officers. Which, that's why C-SPAN got to do, like, cool cameras, and we got to see Greta McGarvey doing her,
a little spell on the House floor.
No, she told me she was singing Moana. I actually saw her.
Oh, wait, no, that was Clara who was doing the spell on the House floor.
Was that what, okay, it was Clara, that's right, not Greta, Clara. Yeah. No, Clara told me she was singing Moana. She's like, people keep telling me I was casting a spell, I wasn't. And I was like, listen, C-SPAN tweeted it, so, but I got it directly from her.
That's amazing.
Yeah. All right. When Mitch McConnell eventually says he will retire, we'll have a much bigger discussion about who's going to be taking over for him here in Kentucky. But I think that's plenty about, like, the implications on the federal scale and how much Mitch McConnell's just, like, done bad things for the country.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Anthony Piacentini. Okay, so Jasmine and I talked a little bit about Anthony Piacentini's trial last week. He is the Metro Council member who took a $200,000 a year job with a company that he steered $40 million in ARP funds towards. At the time when we talked about it last week, the trial just kicked off. We just had one day of trial, but now we've been through day four of the trial, and I think they are taking a break until maybe next week. Anyways, they're on a small break. So just to catch everybody up in terms of what has happened, on the second day of the trial, Grace Simrall testified. She was the chief of innovation and technology. She was brought in by Greg Fisher, and I believe she stayed until the early days of the Greenberg administration. She said that she would have filed a complaint against Piacentini if there hadn't already been one pending. And she said when it was uncovered that Piacentini had taken this job in this group of people that were reviewing where all the art money was going, there was a gasp in the room. And it was that people did not know. They were shocked to see it, and that it was very clear that there was some impropriety going on there. Former council member Bill Hollander also testified on day two, and he said that Piacentini provided more if Piacentini had provided more in-depth reasons for the conflict of interest that he had, that Hollander, you know, would have hit pause on this, because he said in other cases Piacentini had conflicts of interest and went into detail about why he was recusing himself, and when he recused himself in this situation he just said for healthcare reasons or something to that effect. Hollander said he didn't learn about Piacentini's new job until he received a Christmas card from him. Of course, that was after the vote had passed, and that had been after the funding had been awarded, and apparently that Christmas card is now in evidence in the trial. So, I don't know if Bill Hollander saves his Christmas cards, but Allison, after day two, do you think that this testimony is going to have any impact on the trial, that the Simrall and Hollander stuff? Do you think that anybody listening to this is going to hear anything new that might change their vote?
I mean, I hope so. Personally, I hope so.
Which that means probably not, right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But I hope so. I mean, it's just all so corrupt, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know much about the law because I'm not a lawyer by any means, farthest thing from it. But I do know it's been very fascinating to listen to his being Councilman Piacentini's lawyer compared to the prosecution. And it's just been like, to me, what I'm understanding is his attorney is basically saying that Metro Council has set it up to where you could do these kind of things because of the previous people who've been removed from office or tried to have been removed from office. I think they were successfully. No, they weren't all successfully.
Only one managed to survive. Barbara Shanklin, yeah.
And it's just been, fascinating to listen to. I also want to say I'm glad Council President Marcus Winkler's feeling better. He did have the flu and had to do this from, like, a closed off door by himself on Zoom.
Yeah. He's a, he's like a key person in the whole case because
he's a very key key person in all of it.
He was the co-sponsor of the you know, funding with Anthony Piacentini, so he's kind of an important piece of this puzzle. Yeah. We haven't quite heard yet what he was going to say. I think he was supposed to be there on the opening day, and I don't think he has yet testified.
Yeah, he hasn't testified, but he was back in chambers mm-hmm. on the last day.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And he had a mask on, but he was at least free from his...
Yeah, glad he's feeling better. Yeah. Okay, so I just asked you if Grace Simrell or Bill Hollander's testimony was going to matter. You said you hope so, but we agreed probably not. And I think that's going to be a theme for the rest of the testimony. But we'll...
I think it's so funny that you learned this from a Christmas
card. Yeah, yeah. I do think that like the case that the two of them were making, which was like they were people who were intimately involved in, like, you know, Grace Simrell was spent like vetting the bids and making sure that they made sense, and Bill Hollander had a vote on them. And I think what one of the things that they were trying to lay out is, like, in the midst of the process when we were making these decisions, we did not know the whole story, and Anthony Piacentini did not tell us. And so I do think that, like, that is meaningful. Whether it changes anybody's vote, it's something different. So that was day two of the trial. Day three of the trial, the main character was David James, who's the deputy mayor, and at the time, David James was the president of Metro Council. And James said that if he had known the extent of the business ties that formed the reasoning for Piacentini's recusal from voting on the funding, he would have stopped the vote, and he would have actually asked the county attorney for more advice about this vote and about whether or not it could go through the way it did. Piacentini had only said that he was recusing himself because of ties to the healthcare industry, and Piacentini's defense seemed to be about undermining, James's purported lack of knowledge, and about James's purported lack of knowledge about Piacentini's depth of connection with the healthcare CEO council. So I guess what they were basically trying to say is, like, David James knew more than he's telling, you know, this court, and that he wasn't worried about it at the time, and he could have asked questions, and he didn't. He just basically let it go through with the level of information that Piacentini was able to give. Under cross-examination, Kevin Kramer, who for whatever reason is acting as, I guess, like the lawyer. I don't even know if he is. I don't know much about Kevin Kramer. He's been on Metro Council for a million years. His son was a classmate of mine. I should know more about him. But Kevin Kramer asked why he didn't find the recusal strange, since he had been serving on the healthcare advisory committee for months, despite having connections to the healthcare industry. I don't exactly know how this works in their favor to be like, oh, you know, he said he recused himself for healthcare industry reasons, but he didn't recuse himself from the advisory committee. Why didn't you find it weird? I feel like, you know, they're trying to get David James to be like, well, I didn't pay close enough attention. But what they're basically saying is, like, hey, Anthony Piacentini was being shady, and he should be able to get away with being shady. Nobody really caught him, I think, is basically the case that they're trying to make there. This seemed like a little bit of a more wonky day, maybe one where the case that the prosecution is trying to make didn't come through as clearly, but I don't think that the defense, even though they kind of muddied the water, made their client look any better, made Piacentini look any better. But Jasmine, you're not Jasmine. Allison, I mean, anything different you have to say about David James's testimony versus, you know, the day two testimony people? Any reason that the people who are voting on this might change their vote because of David James?
Like I said before, I would hope so.
Yeah, right. So we're in this. we're basically in the same boat for this. All right.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about day four and then talk about this as a whole. So day four saw the trial. Day four of the trial saw the testimony of Jim Griffin. Jim Griffin works for the Louisville Metro Ethics Commission, and he was involved in the original investigation into Piacentini's deal, in which the Ethics Commission recommended the removal of Piacentini. So the issue in day four seemed to be about the timeline, about when Piacentini received his job offer and when he recused himself from the vote on the healthcare CEO council. So according to email logs, Piacentini opened an email that contained a non-disclosure agreement from a person at the CEO council, which I think indicates that he, you know, knew that he was getting the job. They don't just send you an NDA because right. of, you know, oh, here's one just for fun. You know, they're giving it to you for a reason. And he should have known at that point that he was getting the job. And that night, after opening the email, Piacentini called the deal between the city and the CEO council transformational. That's basically saying he got the job and he was still talking about this deal afterwards. Piacentini's, you know, lawyers basically said he could have just, like, opened the email and just kind of glanced at it, then gone about his day, didn't read it fully. But Griffin was like, hey, man, if you see an email from somebody who could be giving you a job for $200,000, you aren't like, oh, I'm just going to click on this and then move on to the next thing. You're reading that thing. And if you're not, especially if you're going to talk about the deal that involves them, you know, you aren't necessarily doing your job. Okay, so that was basically everything that happened on the 3 days of the trial that we haven't talked about it. I don't know what any of this means, because it just seems like Democrats, at the end of the day, all they have to do is pick off one Republican. And I think basically everybody in Metro Council knows the deal. They know everything that happened. We already went through this thing once with the Ethics Commission. And it's just become such a partisan situation, which is exactly what we feared, that it's going to be tough for Democrats to get a Republican to vote for this. I mean, what do you think, Allison? I mean, has your opinion on this changed from the last time we talked about it, or do you feel like, you know, he's going to get away with this, at least in the trial stage?
I think that, number one, as someone who scans emails and doesn't really look at them, you actually look at an email when it's about a job offer or something along those lines. So I find that to be complete BS that he just was glancing at it and didn't read it fully. That's a lie. Like, no, you looked at it, number one. Number two, you know, this shows the importance of elections. I mean, we had a supermajority on Metro Council.
Yep.
In 2022, and wouldn't even have needed to have, like, the need to get one person on the Republican side to jump ship on this if we had still had our supermajority. But because we didn't focus a lot on local elections in 22, this is now that, you know, the outcome of that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it's important to defend the seats that we have in 24 that are up, because this could have all been easily taken care of if we hadn't have lost the seats that we did. And so, and unfortunately, because of that, I don't think he's going to be removed.
Yeah.
It's going to be a vote along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Another reason why we can say elections are important is because, you know, the last time Anthony Piacentini was up for election, we didn't have a challenger for him.
Yep. He ran out of post.
And that's a part of town that's, like, increasingly Democratic. Yep. It's trending more Democratic over time. It's still pretty split, but it's a district that Democrats can win in, especially with a candidate who, you know, while this is about corruption and about just, you know, doing the city dirty, but there was a lot of stuff about Anthony Piacentini that was worth voting against before this.
Easily, yeah. But, like, it's just like you said, it's a lot. Like, this district is trending blue, number one. It's fairly purple. But also, Republicans, as we all know, don't like when their tax dollars are being spent on shit like this, crap like this, sorry, like corruption and stuff. And so, like, this could be such an easy target,
yeah,
for Dems to take the seat back. So regardless of what happens, you know, if we see a surprise and he is removed, great. I hope we get a great candidate out there to take this seat. But he would be up in 26, and I truly hope the party and activists and advocates and community members work together to find someone to take this guy out of this seat, because it's ridiculous, and it's very doable to do. We just need to do the work to find the person.
Yeah, if you live in Middletown, does he have Eastwood? I don't know if he has Eastwood.
It's Middletown, Douglas Hills, Estates part, not the main neighborhood, but, like, up there, up Tucker Station Road. I think, like, behind Eastern.
Yeah, okay, that way.
Middletown, yeah.
It's my I have actually tried to recruit my parents to run, who live in that district, but
someone needs to.
Mom, run for office.
Help me.
Yeah, call my mom. Tell her she needs to run for office. she'll have to finally change her voter registration. So there you go. Okay, that's enough about Anthony Piacentini. It's going to be it's going to be tough to pick him off, but I am glad that this trial is happening, because you know, it's for posterity. We are at least going to see the amount of corruption that goes on on the Republican side of the Metro Council.
Yeah.
Last thing I wanted to talk about are some IVF bills that are making their way through the session. And the reason we want to talk about this is because IVF has become a pretty hot topic. So the Alabama Supreme Court essentially held that IVF was akin to killing a baby. And that happened, I guess, like 2 weeks ago at this point. And red states across the country that have banned abortion are now basically falling over themselves to find a way to ensure that IVF is protected in their state. There are a lot of states where this bills like this are moving, including Alabama, where a bill has already passed. And I believe treatments have resumed. Just to put a pin in the story for a second, I will say that, like, one of the things that's, like, really crazy and tragic about these things is, like, IVF is the thing about it is it's incredibly timed. You have to do one thing after another, and if you know it's based on a cycle, like a woman's cycle, and if you miss the cycle, basically you have to start again a month later. And for a lot of couples that are undergoing IVF, like, a lot of them are older, parents who are trying to have a baby, time is kind of the essence. And, you know, if you also have to start treatment like 2 weeks before, it's crazy. You know, you had people that were giving themselves shots every day in preparation of a transfer that was supposed to happen on a specific day. The Alabama Supreme Court made a ruling, and all of the work they had done to give themselves all of these hormones and to give themselves, like, all of these, do all this work and to put your body through all of that is basically thrown in the garbage because of what the Alabama Supreme Court had to do. That's really brutal. For a lot of these women and for a lot of these couples, like, it's brutal for women on both, like, a mental and, like, a physical situation. And it's, of course, brutal for couples, for those mental reasons. All right. Pin out. We'll talk a little bit more about this. So three bills in Kentucky have been filed that would protect IVF, two Senate bills and one House bill. So the two Senate bills are, one's from Cassie Chambers Armstrong, a Democrat from Louisville, and the other is from Whitney Westerfield, who is a Republican from, I keep seeing people say he's from Fruit Hill. I always said, you know, he was from Hopkinsville, Christian County, but apparently the name of the town he's from is Fruit Hill. They're rather straightforward in protecting IVF. Both of the bills are not very long and do just seek to, you know, protect IVF. I think Whitney Westerfield has a child that was born using a donor embryo, so that's an IVF procedure, but it's not an embryo that him and his wife created. And I think his wife is pregnant with triplets that were also all donor embryos. So IVF, something that Whitney Westerfield is intimately familiar with, and there you go. Those two bills are pretty straightforward. The House bill is from Daniel Grossberg, and it goes further than the Senate bills to protect IVF, saying that an embryo stored outside of a woman's body should not be considered to be alive. So basically, it is codifying what was the law under Roe versus Wade. For IVF specifically, the Senate bills basically just protect the procedure. So, you know, the House bill is significantly preferable, but it is less likely to move because it is a more progressive bill. And it is currently jammed. The House bill does not have a committee assignment. Both Senator Armstrong and Senator Westerfield, their bills have been assigned to committees. Senator Armstrong's bill has been assigned to the Judiciary Committee, where Whitney Westerfield is actually the chair. Whitney Westerfield's bill has been assigned to the Health Services Committee. Whether or not these bills move are highly dependent kind of on Whitney Westerfield. He's kind of the person driving the bus in the Senate here. He can call the bill that Cassie Chambers Armstrong has promoted, or he can work with his own bill in the Health Services Committee to try to see if it gets called. So, Allison, this is an issue that, like, has kind of become a major thing. A lot of Republicans, many of them acting on, like, sincerely held beliefs that IVF is important and should be protected, are pushing for these bills in the wake of this Alabama ruling, and others are doing it for political reasons, seeing that this is, like, a really, really bad issue for them, and there were several hundred people rallying outside of Alabama's capital trying to protect this, so they're seeing that there's a lot of political fallout. What do you think are the likelihood that any of these bills will move or will pass this session?
I think that both in the Senate have a shot at it, especially Whitney's bill. As we all know how Frankfurt works, a Democrat can file something that seems great, but then the Republican, like we talked about with Lindsey Burke a few weeks ago,
yeah,
but then a Republican will steal it and then file it and get it passed. So I think that's what's going to happen here, but it's different a little bit because they both have filed a bill. But I think it's something that is really unfortunate that needs to be passed. I mean, I know a lot of Republican families who are friends of my parents, who are my friends, who are staunchly pro-life, but were born and used IVF.
Mm-hmm.
To have a family because they struggled to get pregnant in some manner. And Whitney Westerfield is a staunch pro-life Republican,
mm-hmm.
who is supporting this. And I think that is really telling, because even after the ruling in Alabama happened, their governor came out and was against it. There's been federal office holders who have been against it. Like, they had no idea this was coming, but It's a thing that is going to impact, like other things, this election as a whole this fall, because the overturn of Roe, you know, the president's campaign is really framing that as Donald Trump's fault. And now you have the IVF involved in it, which isn't going to impact really Kentucky. We all know Trump's going to win Kentucky, but it's going to impact a lot of other things,
mm-hmm.
from local races to federal races. And it's very unfortunate, like I said, that this has to even be filed.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate that Roe versus Wade got overturned for a million different reasons. But I think, you know, I just think back to like Kate Turner's race against Jason Nemes, when she tried to make IVF an issue, right? She was like, because of overturning Roe versus Wade and the fact that this goes to the states, state governments now have the ability to overturn IVF, and they will do it. And Jason Nemes kind of laughed at her and said, there's no way that would ever happen. And we are seeing that, yes, it can in fact happen. It happened
yeah.
in Alabama. You know, they're scrambling to correct it. The U.S. Senate tried to pass a bill to do that, and it was stopped by Cindy Hyde Smith, the aforementioned Cindy Hyde Smith, the senator from Mississippi. This is not something with universal appeal, and anybody who has a sincerely held belief that like life begins at conception or whatever, like, you can't be in favor of IVF. Like, that's just an ideological conundrum that you have to be able to solve. And many Republicans are ideologically consistent and say, no, we don't think that you should be able to have a family if you can't naturally, because of our belief about when conception occurs. Now, there are some Republicans that, I don't know, are setting aside their ideology or tying themselves in ideological knots or whatever, and saying, you know, I believe that life begins at conception, but also that IVF should be available, which I don't understand, but I appreciate their support on IVF as well. I wish they would realize that this also means that they probably should be, you know, not so anti-abortion. But that is neither here. That is probably for a different day. I do hope one of these things pass. Having the additional layer of protection would be good, because it basically says that, you know, no matter what the courts the courts are going to have to basically rule something much more severe than they would in Alabama before IVF would be, you know, gotten rid of in the state. So, you know, I hope that one of these makes their way through this session. But it is something we'll see. You did say, you know, that is true. Whitney Westerfield's bill is probably the one that is going to move, because they only like to move Republican bills. But if the Health Services Committee chairman just is like, I'm not going to prioritize this or whatever, Whitney Westerfield does have the trigger to be like, well, we'll take care of it with this bill. He has a lot of options. And, you know, I said he's like kind of trying to go out in good guy mode. We'll see if this is one of the things he can do on top of that. I wish more Republicans were more brave about more issues before they decided to quit. But that's that.
That's a conversation for a different day.
Yeah, absolutely. Another conversation for a different day. All right. Well, Allison, we're talking to you again in a few weeks. I don't remember exactly when, but people who support your presence here on My Old Kentucky Podcast can
number one fan.
Look forward to another one of these coming up at some point in the near future. It's next week. You're back again next week.
It next week?
It is.
Was the 19th.
Whatever. I have it written down as the 12th. The 19th. I'll double check. You know, listeners, be prepared. There will be at least one more week of Allison Wiseman.
Be prepared. You'll get me at least one more time.
At least one more time. But yeah, thank you for being with us today. I really appreciate your presence, as always.
Always. Yeah. Of course. Thanks for having me.
Go Cards, go Krogering.
I mean, listen, we have 1 week left, and then we all pray.
Baseball season.
Whatever we do, that Kenny Payne is not back.
He's going to win the ACC tournament. They're going to extend him for 5 more years. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Oh, if that happens, first of all, if that happens, I think I would be in such denial of it. Like, I wouldn't even accept it, because I don't think that, my brain can't even process that.
Yeah.
Well. But the women's team tournament starts on Thursday. They're the 5 seed in the ACC tournament. They'll play the winner of, I believe, Clemson and Boston College.
Yeah, and if they win that game, I think they take on Notre Dame, who they just lost to last week.
Notre Dame's one of those, like, it's always it's become a huge rival.
Yeah, the ACC women's tournament's going to be really stacked this year.
It's going to be nuts. I mean, yeah. Anybody could win it, honestly,
and like the top 5-6 teams are all like really really good, so
yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be fun to see, but you know, it's March Madness time. We can all legally bet on it now in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Thank you, Andy Beshear, if you're listening. And it'll be a lot of fun. So,
you know,
we'll wait and see what happens. Do you think the Cats are going to go all the way? What do you think? Oh, that's a conversation for a whole different day.
Banner number 9, hang it or we riot. That's it.
We're calling it. The men's is so wild. I mean, as always, anybody could win it. I think the women in South Carolina are pretty shoe-in to win that tournament, but
I mean, Iowa has shown the ability to beat anybody.
For sure. So, but But
South Carolina is just overwhelmingly good.
Just so good.
It's one of those things about women's basketball that still happens and was a part of the men's game up until like really just about 10 years ago, where every year or many of the years you just have a team that just has the ability to just like steamroll everybody. That just happens very rarely in the men's game anymore because of all the parity and all the money in the training and et cetera. It'll as you know, the women's game has matured a whole lot over the past 3 or 4 years, and I really hope it gets to the point where they have the same sort of situation where there isn't just like as much steamrolling. It is kind of fun whenever the women's game is in transition, because you know, we have like South Carolina now, before we had UConn, before that we had Tennessee, before that we had like Louisiana Tech and Old Dominion. That was before you were born, so you probably don't remember them being good.
I grew up watching Pat Summitt and Candace Parker in Tennessee, and then of course, you know, when I was in middle and high school, was really like peak UConn.
Yeah.
And Geno era. And then the past, like, you know, around 3-4 years really has been South Carolina. So it always just moves in waves.
Yeah. One time, the only time I think that we ever thought about storming the court on Rupp Arena was when Mickey DeMoss and the Kentucky women's team beat Tennessee and Pat Summitt for the first time after losing like 19 straight or something like that. So
yeah,
fun times. All right. That's all, though. Enough about women's basketball.
And we're done talking about women's sports.
Yeah. All right. Well, all right, everybody. If you want to find us, you can do so on Facebook or Instagram.
Always Twitter.
At MyOldKYPod. We have an occasional newsletter at tinyletter.com/MyOldKentuckyNewsletter. We are part of the Dimcast and the Forward Kentucky Networks, and we will see everybody next week. Thank you for listening.